ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Yeah, it's just the blackness and the eerie silence. Only our generator punctuates the noise, and our wonderful black cockies that are still coming back to their dish, which survive.
Over the weekend in WA, renowned scientist Professor Kingsley Dixon was given just 3 minutes to evacuate as an emergency bushfire approached his property near Waroona, south of Perth. David Aitken, too, remembers the helplessness of being trapped in his New South Wales South Coast home during the black summer bushfires of 2019.
It was frightening. It was, the smoke was just pouring over the top. The whole forests were blazing around us, you know.
Now, more Australians are buying bushfire bunkers, but with growing interest comes a need for regulation. I'm Alex Simon and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk country, Perth. Authorities in Western Australia say at least 8 properties have been impacted by a bushfire south of Perth. The quick-moving blaze started in forest near Waroona on Saturday afternoon and has burnt through more than 3,000 hectares. Professor Kingsley Dixon was one of those affected.
We never expected it to arrive with the ferocity that it did. Michael Simmons, who runs the local Waroona Shire, what a champion. He came into our house, looked at me in the eye and said, "You have 3 minutes to get out." And I looked across, all I could see was the first spotting fires, and then it rolled into us. We got out with about a minute to spare.
Professor Kingsley Dixon there. And while fire authorities in WA continue to battle that blaze, debate is growing at the national level on what role fire bunkers could play for residents in high-risk areas and how best to regulate them. More Australians are installing personal bunkers as a last resort safety plan during catastrophic bushfires. While you might associate bunkers with World War II or the Cold War, bunkers are experiencing somewhat of a resurgence around Australia. This increasing popularity, though, has highlighted a national regulation problem. James Tugwell has the story.
David Aitken remembers feeling helpless and spooked as the Black Summer bushfire crisis ripped along the New South Wales south coast. He sheltered in his house on the outskirts of Maroochydore, fearful that every wind change could be fatal. He couldn't evacuate. Fallen trees and road closures blocked any chance to escape.
It was frightening. It was, the smoke was just pouring over the top. The whole forests were blazing around us, you know.
The experience was enough for Mr. Aitken to invest in a bushfire bunker at his property. It's a 7-ton bunker with 10-centimetre thick concrete walls that can fit 6 people. It's only designed to be used for around the crucial half an hour while the fire passes directly overhead.
We're pretty safe, I think, you know. It's not far to run to the bunker from the house, that's for sure.
He says bushfire bunkers are the way of the future.
And as we're learning from California and Hawaii and even Canada had huge fires where their whole villages have gone up. So you're not protected, you know.
The growing national interest in bushfire bunkers comes as no surprise to Wildfire Safety Bunkers CEO Anthony Tratt. His business has boomed since opening in 2010.
It's, they're literally all over Australia. The only state we have never ever sold a bunker into is Northern Territory.
After Black Summer, was there a spike?
Massive spike, yeah. As soon as there's a fire or some, people might feel threatened, there's a fire nearby their property and, they start thinking again, hey, maybe we do need to look at having a backup.
His bunkers retail from $20,000, yet Mr. Tratt says it's a cheap price to pay for the peace of mind they provide. However, the increased demand for bunkers highlights the lack of a national framework for their installation. Adelaide Law School's Dr. Philippa McCormack says every state and territory has a different approach to the bunkers.
The problem is we don't have a consistent, clear and streamlined set of rules where you can go to your local council and they can say, all right, just tick these 6 boxes, do these 4 things and put it in and then you're good. Which doesn't mean you can't get them, it just means you have to take on the cost and the time and the extraordinary complexity of navigating a pathway through a bunch of laws that don't specifically say, here's exactly what you need.
Part of the issue, according to Dr. McCormack, is authorities are hesitant to endorse bunkers as a bushfire survival strategy.
What the fire agency or the land use planning authority cannot say to them is, buy this, you definitely won't die. No one can say that, because catastrophic fire, you can't guarantee safety from that.
A spokesperson for the New South Wales Rural Fire Service says bunkers don't substitute for a bushfire safety plan. In a statement, they said inadequately designed, badly located and poorly maintained private bushfire shelters are extremely dangerous. They added the safest place to be is away from the fire. Dr. McCormack says the complicated legal process means people who want bunkers will still install them, sometimes building makeshift shelters themselves. A royal commission after Victoria's Black Saturday in 2009 found many people sheltered in completely unsuitable locations.
People can't always evacuate. We really need a plan for those people who are looking for something to keep themselves safe. Maybe we could just make it more streamlined and more accessible for ordinary people to put in place a shelter that's going to keep them safer than their lawn or their toilet or their car. And we need to make sure that those bunkers, that infrastructure that we want to install is solid, is good, is effective. But there's an element of like, pretty much anything would be better than this.
Dr. McCormack says authorities might be concerned that by approving bunkers, residents become complacent and don't prepare their homes or evacuate early.
I suspect that that's probably an education and a communication issue rather than a legal issue. The response to that would be, here is a streamlined process to access a bunker. We're going to put it in place. We're going to check in on you. But also, you share with us your plan to evacuate early. Your bunker isn't your first plan for safety. It's your last resort if other plans fail. Thing is, other plans will fail. You know, people's first plan to leave early sometimes is not able to be implemented. From my perspective, a streamlined process, readily accessible, and then couched in good information and education tools would be a really brilliant step forwards.
Currently, Victoria is the only state with a clear pathway outlining what a bunker is and what is needed for it to be approved. It's also the state where Mr. Tratt has by far sold the most bunkers. Dr. McCormack says there is an urgent need for a national approach that could follow the Victorian model and see Australia become a world leader.
We could show people what it looks like to have ordinary landholders equipped and ready to evacuate early and survive. That's going to be something that other people are going to want to know, because as the climate changes, fire is hitting places that haven't been traditional flame zones. And we just don't have time. Like, the next catastrophic fire season is any year now, and we need to give people a chance. We could definitely lead the world on this.
Adelaide Law School's Dr. Philippa McCormack speaking with James Tugwell.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
One of Ballarat's most prominent cathedrals looks very different at the moment. For years, the fence outside St Patrick's Cathedral has been covered in colourful ribbons, tied as a show of support for survivors of institutional child sexual abuse. But parishioners were out removing those ribbons on Saturday morning, something they say needed to be done to allow the historic wrought iron fence to be repainted. About a dozen survivors and supporters gathered to protest the removal of the ribbons, saying the church hasn't properly consulted them during the process and about the future of the ribbons. Ballarat reporter Rochelle Kirkham was there on Saturday and filed this report.
Ballarat was an epicentre for institutional child sexual abuse for many decades in the 20th century. It's where some of Australia's most notorious paedophile priests worked. Their crimes continue to have devastating effects throughout the entire community, with trauma continuing to ripple through generations. For survivors of child sexual abuse and their supporters, colourful ribbons tied to the fences of Ballarat institutions, known as loud fences, represent so much.
Well, the ribbons are an invitation to for discussion, for people to talk about what has happened and recognise the trauma that people have experienced and to, I guess, seek acknowledgement from the institutions, from the church itself, particularly the cathedral here, of what has happened. People still don't feel acknowledged, do not feel heard.
That's Mark O'Brien, Vice Chair of grassroots community organisation Loud Fence. On Saturday morning, Mr. O'Brien joined about a dozen survivors of child sexual abuse and their supporters to peacefully protest, while hundreds of ribbons tied to the fence outside St. Patrick's Cathedral were removed. They linked arms and watched while parishioners used Stanley knives to cut off the ribbons and place them in plastic boxes to allow for maintenance and repainting work to be carried out on the ageing wrought iron fence.
It's difficult to watch you, because I mean, I've got mates who have suffered tremendously, and that's, you know, can't put it in words, I've got mates who are dead. I just hope that their lives, their stories will never be forgotten. Taking down the ribbons is not an action to forget.
The Diocese of Ballarat met with Loud Fence members in February to discuss the removal process and future plans for the ribbons. Vicar General Marcello Colasanti says there will be further consultation with survivors about what to do with the ribbons in the future.
The maintenance of the fence needs to be carried out. I think it was always going to be a point of tension, the actual removal of the ribbons. The parish will be open to whatever suggestions come forward as a result of the consultation that will take place after the ribbons have been removed. One suggestion that has been put forward from ourselves was that those ribbons might be displayed in some kind of a display case and a memorial then erected within the cathedral grounds.
Mr. O'Brien says he wants to see the diocese conduct meaningful consultation with survivors, as many feel like they've never properly been listened to or heard.
There's a tendency, I think, everywhere, and has been exhibited by the church itself, to cover things up. And if this is done quickly, it would just be another sort of like, let's just tidy this up to a corner and make sure that, yeah, we've done something, we've said there's abuse, yeah, right, let's just move on. It's very hard to move on when there's not an acceptance, an acknowledgement of what suffering has occurred. This is an opportunity now for the cathedral and the parish to actually show that they get what's happening, that they're wanting to acknowledge the past and be able to also assure people of what now will happen in the present and future.
Tony Wardley is one of the survivors of institutional child sexual abuse who protested the removal of ribbons on Saturday. He says he and others will be retying ribbons to the fence once it has been repainted.
They can do what they like, but they will be back. And they'll stay there until every child is safe, until they confess their sins instead of covering them up over and over and over again.
Father Colasanti says he cannot guarantee the diocese will allow new ribbons to stay on the fence once it has been repainted, because the consultation process is ongoing.
Rochelle Kirkham with that story from Ballarat. Let's head to the Northern Territory now, where almost 3 years after the Aboriginal Justice Agreement was signed, the first sign of a major overhaul of the Territory's justice system has appeared on Groot Island, around 600 kilometres east of Darwin. The first community court sitting has taken place, allowing Aboriginal elders to be involved in the sentencing of some offenders. The Northern Territory's chief judge says the system has enormous potential to reduce recidivism and the overrepresentation of Aboriginal people in the Territory's jails. Darwin Court reporter Melissa McKay has been following this story. Melissa, greater community involvement when it comes to Aboriginal justice has been a goal across many parts of the country. The Koori Court in Victoria was one of the first Australian sentencing courts for Aboriginal offenders. So how does this new community court work there in the Territory? How is it different to the existing system?
Well, it works sort of alongside the existing system, and at the moment the community courts are only operating in this one particular community in Groot Island, and it's sort of working alongside the community or the circuit court. So in the Northern Territory, the local court sits obviously in Darwin, Tennant Creek, Alice Springs, and Katherine. But then every couple of months or so, the judges and the court will travel out to remote communities. And so we've got these circuit courts, which are, you know, the local court in community. But now we've got these community courts, which are essentially an extension of that. And so people can be referred to the community court for sentencing, and it's then that they can be, their sentencing is essentially kind of a team effort, I suppose, where Aboriginal leaders from that community will help to inform the judge on appropriate sentences for this person in a way that, you know, will best teach them about what they've done and how it's impacted the community, and also will allow the offender to better represent themselves before the judge in terms of being able to provide the court and the judge with more information about their background and, you know, their circumstances.
Let's hear from NT Chief Judge Elizabeth Morris, who's been a big supporter of this particular program.
It's still the same Sentencing Act. So we still use all the same powers. There's no additional sentences that we give. But what is different is that the community will come up with some of the solutions that they think are going to work for that person and for the community.
That's NT Chief Judge Elizabeth Morris there talking about the community court, essentially, that's now operating on Groote Island in the Northern Territory. So, Melissa, when will the community court be used? Will it only apply to certain offences?
It will. It will only apply to offences that can be sentenced in the local court. So there's obviously a threshold of particular crimes that need to be dealt with by the Supreme Court. So we're not going to be seeing charges like murder and manslaughter, etc., being dealt with in the community court. And the only people who can access the community court are those who have pleaded guilty in the circuit court or the local court setting. So they have to have pleaded guilty and accepted responsibility for the charges against them before they can go to the community court. They also need to be accepted by the community court. So their lawyer can have them referred to the community court, but those leaders who sit on the Law and Justice group, which informs the community court, need to accept them as well as someone that that they are willing to assist through that sentencing process.
What type of input will elders and community members have when it comes to sentencing? What's expected here?
So the judge will, of course, still have, I guess, the final say, right? They still need to sentence along with the Sentencing Act of the Northern Territory. But these sorts of, I guess, the advice that can be given by the Law and Justice group in the community courts will be sort of, I guess, things like that the judge or corrections may not necessarily have thought about. And so some of the examples that the chief judge gave to me in our conversation were things like, you know, someone could be court ordered to help elders in the community in gathering bush foods that they may not be able to go and get themselves anymore. They could be sentenced or ordered to partake in more sort of cultural ceremonies and things like that. Although they'll still be sentenced in a way that is consistent with Northern Territory legislation, it does allow the judge to make these other orders, which you know, can really hold someone to account, but in a way that I guess best helps them to understand the impact of what they've done and to repay the community for the effects of their crime.
In my introduction, we talked about rates of recidivism and hopefully bringing that down. Is that the main aim here?
Yeah, it is. It's to try and, I guess, help people to better understand the impact of what they've done. On Groote Island as well, where the community court is rolling out, they're also about to open an alternative to custody facility, which will be a rehabilitation centre that is on country where people can be sentenced to, as opposed to, you know, being sent to Darwin to prison. It's supposed to be a more sort of therapeutic approach. And so the goal here is to, you know, help these two worlds work together better. You know, the Western legal system is very different to the systems that are in place in remote communities, and those systems in remote communities differ from community to community. So, you know, it's going to look different in every community that that these courts are rolled out in, but it's supposed to, you know, better help the community to understand how the system is working and to show that, you know, it can better work with community as opposed to, I guess, against it.
Just on those two worlds working together, what checks and balances are there to ensure appropriate sentencing as well as cultural input can work together?
Yeah, so of course the judge that is sentencing is of course still bound by the Northern Territory Sentencing Act, and so the sentences do still need to be appropriate when it comes to the legislation. There's also some pretty strict boxes to tick for those on the Law and Justice group, those leaders who are helping to inform the judge. They all need to pass a police check and be ticked off by the Attorney General's Department before they can take part in community court as well.
Well, let's hear from the NT Attorney General, Chancey Paike. Here's what he's had to say.
Every consequence that is being delivered through this program is in line with international human rights declarations and making sure that those are the appropriate sentences in place.
That's the NT Attorney General, Chancey Paike, there. And just finally, Melissa, you mentioned that this could be rolled out elsewhere. Is that the plan?
Yeah, it is. At the moment, it is, of course, only running on Groote Eylandt, but there are plans. The Attorney General said to hopefully roll this out across a handful of communities, even before the end of the year. There are communities like Yuendumu down a little bit further south in the Northern Territory, as well as Maningrida, Kintore, Ramanginning and Binjari, hopefully before the end of the year. But as we've heard, you know, the community court system will look different in every community that it's running in. And so it could take some time to get this all sort of set up in those communities.
That's Darwin Court reporter Melissa McKay. Melissa, thanks for speaking to Australia Wide once again.
Anytime. Thank you.
ABC Australia Wide.
Hiding in front, and 50, 60 in front. Hiding in 6-0, 170. That's a lane. Hiding in front now, 190.
And finally here on Australia Wide, the very best of Australia's young auctioneers have been crowned at the Sydney Royal Easter Show. Justin Oakenfull of Inverell in northern New South Wales took out the 2024 ALPA National Young Auctioneer title. Lara Webster caught up with him as he walked off the stage.
I can see the smile on your face, but I tell you, Justin, when it was mentioned and when they announced you were the national champ, I think the sweat was pouring off you by the time that announcement came through. What was it like when you heard your name called out?
It was a big shock to start with, and a very big thrill. It's an honour and a privilege to receive it and be crowned the champion, and it's just been awesome.
Going into the competition, how confident were you were going to take the title?
No, I wasn't confident at all, to be honest. It was business as usual, and you know, tried our best to prepare for it and just lucky enough to get away with it today.
You had a big crowd up there, but not one of you looked nervous at all. I suspect you all have very good poker faces, but what was it like when you were standing up there and you got to that final steer? What were you thinking by then?
Oh, to be honest, not much. It was just, you know, obviously your first one always goes quicker, then you've got to try and regroup and get into your second and really finish on a high with the third. But it was, I'm lucky enough to have been down here a couple of times in the New South Wales comp, so I've had a little bit of experience with the crowd and the amphitheatre, but it's certainly a nerve-wracking experience, and you need to, you know, learn how to control your nerves.
So what does this mean for you going forward? National champion, you get to go over to the Calgary Stampede. World Championships. What does that feel like to know that's where you're headed next, the World Championship?
It's, like I said, very humbled and honoured. It's just still surreal, and words can't explain how I feel.
So what happens now to make sure you're as prepared as every other auctioneer that ends up there?
Oh, I'll talk one of my best mates, well, he is my best mate, he won it last year, Harry Waters, so I'd say 1,000 phone calls with him.
Have a good coach.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course, we had another local runner-up from Manila, Michael Pirtle.
Yeah.
Two from the northwest, not bad going.
Yeah, no, it's very good for our area and awesome for New South Wales to retain the team shield. It was very good.
My name's Darcy Howard. I'm based at Cowra, but work for MCC Chudley Dobell at Forbes, and I've been lucky enough to win the 2024 State Young Auctioneers competition for New South Wales. So,
let's just start with what it feels like to be able to say that.
Yeah, it's pretty unbelievable. It's something I definitely didn't expect, but I just feel so privileged and so honoured to receive this award. You look back at some of the people that have won this award in past years, and to have my name on the trophy with the likes of some of those agents, I just so honoured and I just got so many people to thank, and it's awesome.
What does it mean for you and your work as an auctioneer going forward now?
It's obviously a notch in your belt. You know, being an agent for me, it's more than being an auctioneer. It's, you know, it's doing a good job for your clients and their businesses. But you know, it's you know, just to be recognised in this way is so you know, such a privilege.
That was Darcy Howard, the New South Wales Young Auctioneer Champion, speaking with Lara Webster. And that is Australia Wide for this Monday. I'm Alex Hyman. I'll be back again with you tomorrow. Hope you can join me then. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.